Chapter 13. The mind, enervators of intellect, fathers of idleness, and what not, let us at once take a high ground, and say, go you to your own employments, and to such dull studies as you fancy. Go and bob for triangles, from the ponds of Cinerum. Go enjoy your dull black drafts of metaphysics. Go fumble over history books, and dissert upon Herodotus and Livy. Our histories are, perhaps, as true as yours. Our drink is the brisk sparkling champagne drink, from the presses of Colburn, Bentley, and Company. Semicolon, our walks are over such sunshiny pleasure grounds as Scott and Shakespeare have laid out for us. And if our dwellings are castles in the air, we find them excessively splendid and commodious. Be not ill envious, because you have no wings to fly thither. Let the big wigs despise us. Such contempt of their neighbors is the custom of all barbarous tribes. Witness, the learned Chinese. Tipu Sultan declared that there were not in all Europe 10,000 men. The Sclavonic hordes, it is said, so entitled themselves from a word in their jargon, which signifies, oh speak, the ruffians imagining that they had a monopoly of this agreeable faculty, and that all other nations were dumb. Not so. Others may be deaf, but the novelist has a loud, eloquent, instructive language, though his enemies may despise or deny it ever so much. What is more, one could, perhaps, meet the stoutest historian on his own ground, and argue with him, showing that sham histories were much truer than real histories, which are, in fact, mere contemptible catalogues of names and places that can have no moral effect upon the reader. As thus, Julius Caesar beat Pompey at Pharsalia. The Duke of Marlborough beat Marshal Tallard at Blenheim. The Constable of Bourbon beat Francis I at Pavia. And what have we here? So many names, simply. Suppose Pharsalia had been, at that mysterious period when names were given, called Pavia, and that Julius Caesar's family name had been John Churchill, the fact would have stood in history, thus. Pompey ran away from the Duke of Marlborough at Pavia. And why not? We should have been just as wise. Or it might be stated that the 10th Legion charged the French infantry at Blenheim, and Caesar, writing home to his mama, said, Madame, tout est perdu fors l'honneur. Apostrophe, what a contemptible science this is, then, about which quartos are written, and 60-volume biographies universelles, and Lardner's cabinet cyclopedias, and the like. The facts are nothing in it, the name's everything, and a gentleman might as well improve his mind by learning Walker's Azetir, or getting by heart a 50-years-old edition of the York Guide. Having thus disposed of the historians, let us come to the point in question, the novelists. On the title page of these volumes the reader has, doubtless, remarked that among the pieces introduced, some are announced as copies and oppositions. Many of the histories have, accordingly, been neatly stolen from the collections of French authors and mutilated, according to the old saying, so that their owners should not know them, and, for compositions, we intend to favor the public with some studies of French modern works that have not as yet, we believe, attracted the notice of the English public. Of such works there appear many hundreds yearly, as may be seen by the French catalogues. But the writer has not so much to do with works political, philosophical, historical, metaphysical, scientifical, theological, as with those for which he has been putting forward a plea novels, namely, on which he has expended a great deal of time and study. And passing from novels in general to French novels, let us confess, with much humiliation, that we borrow from these stories a great deal more knowledge of French society than from our own personal observation we ever can hope to gain. For, let a gentleman who has dwelt 2, 4, or 10 years in Paris and has not gone thither for the purpose of making a book, when 3 weeks are sufficient, let an English gentleman say, at the end of any given period, how much he knows of French society, how many French houses he has entered, and how many French friends he has made. he has enjoyed, at the end of the year, say, at the English ambassador's, so many soirees. At houses to which he has brought letters, so many tea parties. At cafes, so many dinners. At French private houses, say 3 dinners, and very lucky too. He has, we say, seen an immense number of wax candles, cups of tea, glasses of orgeat, and French people, in best clothes, enjoying the same, but intimacy there is none. We see but the outsides of the people. Year by year we live in France, and grow gray, and see no more. We play écarté with Monsieur de Trifle every night, but what know we of the heart of the man of the inward ways, thoughts, and customs of Trifle? If we have good legs, and love the amusement, we dance with Countess Flick Flack, Tuesdays, and Thursdays, ever since the peace. And how far are we advanced in acquaintance with her, since we first twirled her round a room? We know her velvet gown, and her diamonds, about 3/4 of them are sham, by the way. We know her smiles, and her simpers, and her rouge, but no more. She may turn into a kitchen wench at 12 on Thursday night, for aught we know, her voiture, a pumpkin, and her gens, so many rats. But the real, rougeless, in time Flick Flack, we know not. This privilege is granted to no Englishman. We may understand the French language as well as Monsieur de Levizac, but never can penetrate into Flick Flack's confidence. Our ways are not her ways. Our manners of thinking, not hers. When we say a good thing, in the course of the night, we are wondrous lucky and pleased. Flick Flack will trill you off 50 in 10 minutes, and wonder at the betise of the Briton, who has never a word to say. We are married, and have 14 children, and would just as soon make love to the Pope of Rome, as to anyone but our own wife. If you do not make love to Flick Flack, from the day after her marriage to the day she reaches 60, she thinks you a fool. We won't play at écarté with Trifle on Sunday nights, and are seen walking, about 1 o'clock, accompanied by 14 red-haired children, with 14 gleaming prayer books, away from the church. Grand Dieu! Cries Trifle, is that man mad? He won't play at cards on a Sunday, he goes to church on a Sunday. He has 14 children. Was ever Frenchman known to do likewise? Pass we on to our argument, which is, that with our English notions and moral and physical constitution, it is quite impossible that we should become intimate with our brisk neighbors. And when such authors as Lady Morgan and Mrs. Trollope, having frequented a certain number of tea parties in the French capital, begin to prattle about French manners and men, with all respect for the talents of those ladies, we do believe their information, not to be worth a sixpence. They speak to us not of men, but of tea parties. Tea parties are the same all the world over. With the exception that, with the French, there are more lights and prettier dresses, and with us, a mighty deal more tea in the pot. There is, however, a cheap and delightful way of traveling, that a man may perform in his easy chair, without expense of passports or postboys. On the wings of a novel, from the next circulating library, he sends his imagination a gadding, and gains acquaintance with people, and manners whom he could not hope otherwise to know. Twopence a volume bears us whithersoever we will, back to Ivanhoe and Pierre the Lion, or to Waverley and the Young Pretender, along with Walter Scott, up the heights of fashion with the charming enchanters of the Silver Fork School, or, better still, to the snug inn parlor, or the jovial tap room, with Mr. Pickwick and his faithful Sancho Weller. I am sure that a man who, 100 years hence, should sit down to write the history of our time, would do wrong to put that great contemporary history of Pickwick aside as a frivolous work. It contains true character under false names, and, like Roderick Random, an inferior work, and Tom Jones, one that is immeasurably superior, gives us a better idea of the state and ways of the people than one could gather from any more pompous or authentic histories. We have, therefore, introduced into these volumes one or two short reviews of French fiction writers, of particular classes, whose Paris sketches may give the reader some notion of manners in that capital. If not original, at least the drawings are accurate. For, as a Frenchman might have lived 1,000 years in England, and never could have written Pickwick, an Englishman cannot hope to give a good description of the inward thoughts and ways of his neighbors. To a person inclined to study these, in that light and amusing fashion in which the novelist treats them, let us recommend the works of a new writer, Monsieur de Bernard, who has painted actual manners, without those monstrous and terrible exaggerations in which late French writers have indulged, and who, if he occasionally wounds the English sense of propriety as what French man or woman alive will not, does so more by slighting than by outraging it, as, with their labored descriptions of all sorts of imaginable wickedness, some of his brethren of the press have done. M. de Bernard's characters are men and women of genteel society rascals enough, but living in no state of convulsive crimes, and we follow him in his lively, malicious account of their manners, without risk of lighting upon any such horrors as Balzac or Dumas has provided for us. Let us give an instance. It is from the amusing novel called Essayes d'Écart, and contains what is to us quite a new picture of a French fashionable rogue. The fashions will change in a few years, and the rogue, of course, with them. Let us catch this delightful fellow ere he flies. It is impossible to sketch the character in a more sparkling gentlemanlike way than M. de Bernard's. But such light things are very difficult of translation, and the sparkle sadly evaporates during the process of decanting. A French fashionable letter. My dear Victor, it is 6 in the morning. I have just come from the English ambassador's ball, and as my plans for the day do not admit of my sleeping, I write you a line. For, at this moment, saturated as I am with the enchantments of a fairy night, all other pleasures would be too wearisome to keep me awake, except that of conversing with you. Indeed, were I not to write to you now, when should I find the possibility of doing so? Time flies here with such a frightful rapidity, my pleasures and my affairs whirl onwards together in such a torrentious gallopade, that I am compelled to seize occasion by the forelock, for each moment has its imperious employ. Do not then accuse me of negligence. If my correspondence has not always that regularity which I would fain give it, attribute the fault solely to the whirlwind in which I live, and which carries me hither and thither at its will. However, you are not the only person with whom I am behindhand. I assure you, on the contrary, that you are one of a very numerous and fashionable company, to whom, towards the discharge of my debts, I propose to consecrate 4 hours today. I give you the preference to all the world, even to the lovely Duchess of San Severino, a delicious Italian, whom, for my special happiness, I met last summer at the waters of Aix. I have also a most important negotiation to conclude with one of our princes of finance. But Nimpert, I commence with thee. Friendship before love or money, friendship before everything. My dispatch is concluded. I am engaged to ride with the Marquis de Grignard, the Comte de Castijars, and Lord Cobham, in order that we may recover, for a breakfast at the Rocher de Cancale, that Grignard has lost, the appetite which we all of us so cruelly abused last night at the ambassador's gala. On my honor, my dear fellow, everybody was of a caprice prestigieux and a comfortable mirabolant. Fancy, for a banquet hall, a royal orangery hung with white damask, the boxes of the shrubs transformed into so many sideboards, lights gleaming through the foliage, and, for guests, the loveliest women and most brilliant cavaliers of Paris. Orleans and Nemours were there, dancing and eating like simple mortals. In a word, Albion did the thing very handsomely, and I accord it my esteem. Here I pause, to call for my valet de chambre, and call for tea, for my head is heavy, and I've no time for a headache. In serving me, this rascal of a Frederick has broken a cup, through Japan. Upon my honor, the rogue does nothing else. Yesterday, for instance, did he not thump me prodigiously by letting fall a goblet after Cellini, of which the carving alone cost me 300 francs? I must positively put the wretch out of doors to ensure the safety of my furniture. And in consequence of this, Ennius, an audacious young negro, in whom wisdom hath not waited for years, Ennius, my groom, I say, will probably be elevated to the post of valet de chambre. But where was I? I think I was speaking to you of an oyster breakfast, to which, on our return from the Parc du Bois, a company of pleasant rakes are invited. After quitting Borles, we propose to adjourn to the Barrière du Combat, where Lord Cobham proposes to try some bulldogs, which he has brought over from England. One of these, O'Connell, Lord Cobham is a Tory, has a face in which I place much confidence. I have a bet of 10 louis with Castigars on the strength of it. After the fight, we shall make our accustomed appearance at the Café de Paris, apostrophe the only place, by the way, where a man who respects himself may be seen, and then away with frocks and spurs, and on with our dress coats for the rest of the evening. In the first place, I shall go doze for a couple of hours at the opera, where my presence is indispensable, for Corelli, a charming creature, passes this evening from the rank of the rats to that of the tigers, in a pose de trois, and our box patronizes her. After the opera, I must show my face to two or three salons in the Faubourg Saint-Honor, and having thus performed my duties to the world of fashion, I return to the exercise of my rights as a member of the carnival. At 2 o'clock all the world meets at the Theatre Ventadour. Lions and tigers, the whole of our menagerie will be present. Evo! Off we go! Roaring and bounding bacchanal and saturnal, 'tis agreed that we shall be everything that is low. To conclude, we sup with Castigars, the most furiously disheveled orgy that ever was known. The rest of the letter is on matters of finance, equally curious and instructive. But pause we for the present to consider the fashionable part. And caricature as it is, we have an accurate picture of the actual French dandy. Bets, breakfasts, riding, dinners at the Café de Paris, and delirious carnival balls. The animal goes through all such frantic pleasures at the season that precedes Lent. He has a wondrous respect for English gentlemen sportsmen. He imitates their clubs, their love of horse flesh. He calls his palefrenier a groom, wears blue bird's eye neckcloths, sports his pink out hunting, rides steeple chases, and has his jockey club. The eigers and lions alluded to in the report have been borrowed from our own country, and a great compliment is it to Monsieur de Bernard, the writer of the above amusing sketch, that he has such a knowledge of English names and things, as to give a Tory lord the decent title of Lord Cobham, and to call his dog O'Connell. Paul de Kock calls an English nobleman, in one of his last novels, Lord Billingrog, and appears vastly delighted at the verisimilitude of the title. For the eugismens et bondismens, bacchanale et saturnale, gallop infernal, rendu sabotout le tremblement, these words give a most clear untranslatable idea of the carnival ball. A sight more hideous can hardly strike a man's eye. I was present at one, where the 4,000 guests whirled screaming, reeling, roaring, out of the ballroom in the Rue Saint-Honor, and tore down to the column in the Place Vendôme, round which they went shrieking their own music, 20 miles an hour, and so tore madly back again. Let a man go alone to such a place of amusement, and the sight for him is perfectly terrible. The horrid frantic gaiety of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.